Welcome to Social Workers Break Room. This is Imelda.
And I'm Jennifer.
And today we bring you how to choose the best trainings and CEUs. Wait, should we say something like, welcome to season number two? We shouldn't, huh?
We're doing a time capsule wardrobe podcast.
Yeah.
All right.
Stay with us.
So depending on your state, you may have a rolling deadline for your CEUs or continuing education units based on the date you got your license, or you may have a particular month or year all of your CEUs are due. But as social workers, we make a commitment to being well-trained in evidence-based practices and interventions. And CEUs and trainings and certifications and conferences can do that. So today we're going to go over an overview of how to choose the right trainings for you. Mm-hmm. So, Imelda, what was the last training or conference you went to, and how was it?
If I remember correctly, it was early 2020. It feels like so long ago. It was before COVID, of course.
BC.
Yes, BC, before COVID. I think it was January and like some parts of February of 2020. And I remember during the training, we talked about how COVID was spreading in other countries and, you know, it had not hit the U.S. yet, or it was not as prevalent. So it's so funny that we actually talked about it, like, oh, you know, like how the rest of the world is going through this.
Like a hypothetical.
Yes. And it didn't hit us yet and how things were about to change so much. But the training that I attended was a fundraising accelerate program. Since I'm currently in the fundraising world, and that's one of the main responsibilities of my job, I attended the Stanford Maricopa Fundraising Academy Accelerate, and we actually put the link on the resources for the episode if anyone wants to check it out. I think they also have online programs that you can be part of. But this was a fundraising program focused in Arizona, mm-hmm. focused in some of the agencies and corporations that we have here in Arizona and in the Phoenix area. The trainer was one of the top fundraising professionals in one of the agencies that provides crisis intervention for children who have been abused or neglected. So it's an agency that it's pretty well known here in the community and well supported by people in Arizona and Phoenix. So it was very good. It was 6 weeks, I believe. Mm-hmm. And so it was one session per week, and it was an all-day training. So I had to step away from my job responsibilities for the day to attend the session, but it was really good.
Awesome. And how did you choose that, or was that chosen for you?
It was a mix. I found the opportunity through some other social work, you know, colleagues in the field, not necessarily through my job, but I presented it to my supervisor as an opportunity for me to, you know, continue growing my professional skills and also be getting connected with other fundraising professionals in Arizona and Phoenix. And my supervisor was completely on board with it. She felt it was a great opportunity and so gave me the green light for me to sign up and register. And I think my employer offered to cover the mm-hmm. the fees for the training as well. So it was a good experience for me.
Awesome.
Yeah.
I think those are all really important things to consider that we'll expand on. You know, for me, you know, how to choose or if it's being chosen for you, some of my top driving forces are, is it something I'm going to use and something you're passionate about? So, you know, it kind of drives me bonkers when people do things like get trained in EMDR or brain spotting when they hate treating trauma and they work in, say, like hospice, right? Like somewhere where it completely doesn't make sense. Another factor, like you mentioned, is cost. So if you're thinking about cost or investment, you may be able to advocate for a stipend, or if you can get the whole training covered, like it sounds like you were, mm-hmm. That can be great. Some employers won't cover training certifications or CEUs, but you might be able to advocate for a certain number of training days a year or to use your PTO or to get additional PTO days to use for training. another thing you can do is also talk to friends, or if you're in any of the Facebook groups, you can make a post about a training that you want to attend. Often, if you can find five people to sign up together, you can get a group rate or a discount. So it's not necessarily that you have to have, you know, all the same email address or all the same, you know, from the same organization. It's just that you're all attending together.
Yeah, it's funny that you mentioned that, because actually the training that I took, it was like a 2-for-1 type of deal. So I found another colleague, she doesn't work with me, but she works at a different agency, that she reached out to me and said like, hey, like this, there's this opportunity and they're doing 2-for-1. So if we can go halves, and actually that decreased the cost for me. And that's why my employer was able to cover it, because it was a cheaper price for me. So, yeah, like Jennifer says, there are some trainings that offer group rates, and you might be able to get together with a few of your friends or colleagues and coworkers and do it together for a cheaper price.
Yeah. And even if you don't see it, it never hurts to ask. Mm-hmm. You know, if you find five people, or even if you find one other person, you know, do you do a 2-for-1? Do you do a group rate? Another thing a lot of trainings will do, especially if they're like large or national organizations, or if you work full time for a nonprofit, often they'll have a discount. You know, they want practitioners to be trained up to date. And that's, you know, part of sometimes what agencies will do kind of philanthropically, is they'll say you serve an underserved community at a nonprofit, you know, versus charging, you know, clinicians who live in like a highly affluent area who do private practice, right? Like they may have more opportunity to afford a training than someone who works in, say, community mental health in an underserved area for a nonprofit. They might have a little less bandwidth for that stipend, for, you know, their employer paying for the training. So you can always ask for a discount at those. The most common place I actually see it is for EMDR, which we'll talk about in a bit later, but most EMDR trainers offer a full-time nonprofit discount, which is great.
Question, do you know, and I just thought about this, do you know if any of those costs, let's say that my employer doesn't pay for it and I cover it from my pocket, could we report that at the end of the year in your tax report as a professional development? I think you do.
Yeah, so that's a great question. So if it is related to your W-2 employer, then usually not. If you have an LLC or an S-Corp, like let's say you either are in private practice or going into private practice, as long as it advances your skills that are directly related to what you filed your LLC under in most states, then you can. So let's say if I registered my LLC as a yoga therapist and then I went to go get EMDR training, it's not directly related to what my LLC is for. Or let's say I registered my LLC for, you know, the flip side, right? Like maybe I'm an EMDR therapist and I go get yoga trained, right? Mm-hmm. I can't write that off because it's not directly advancing my skills. Also, unfortunately, degrees don't count, but like most of us have probably experienced with taxes. Thankfully, those have other things to get written off under. But so sometimes if you have an LLC or an S-Corp or considering filing for one of those, because you may want to go into private practice or consulting one day, then you can write off a reasonable amount of that is related to the advancement and growth of your business.
Awesome.
Yeah, that's a great question. So for those of you with a license, another thing to consider is, does it provide CEUs in my state? And my follow-up question to that is, am I sure, or is there someone I need to check with? I am licensed in 4 states now, so I have to be really careful and make sure that when I get CEUs, I really need to make sure that they're covered in all of my states. New York State, for example, has a lot of additional kind of hoops that organizations have to jump through to be a certified CEU provider in the state of New York versus, you know, Arizona and Pennsylvania, another state I'm licensed in. We'll often say if it's from a large reputable organization that it's been, you know, blessed by for one state, like the ASWB, the NASW, the CSWE, the APA, then they say, you know, if one state thinks this is good enough for their chapter, then it's probably good for you to bring in here. But a lot of state boards have someone that you can send them the training in advance and say, hey, here's their CEU certificate number. You know, is this okay? And most of the time, they'll probably say yes, unless they're the state of New York. Then they'll say they need to go through the Office of Professions credentialing process. Another thing to consider is, how many is it worth and in what category? So different states have different requirements. You know, for example, in New Mexico, I had to get 3 hours of cultural credits. Nice. In Pennsylvania and New York, I had to get, I think, 3 for my initial license and then 2 for my license renewal for child abuse protection, that specific mandated reporting laws for those states. For Pennsylvania, I had to get 1 for suicide prevention. For Florida, you have to get 1 for HIV. So different states have different priorities that have typically been introduced in their legislature that require a certain number of a certain kind of CEO.
I'm guessing most of those are based on the needs of the community and that state.
Yeah. You know, it's interesting, you know, when we see kind of the spread of that, like the ones in New Mexico, it's very focused on like their Native and Hispanic population, mm-hmm. And meeting those specific cultural needs is what it's based around. But then, you know, for example, Pennsylvania, they had a really high rate of suicide for a long time. And, you know, some folks advocated at the state legislature that everyone who's licensed in the state needs to be trained in recognizing and treating suicide. But, you know, funny enough, or not funny at all, actually, you know, New Mexico currently has the highest rate of suicides, but they don't require it. But my Pennsylvania license does. So yeah, it's really, you know, like we see with a lot of state bills, you know, somebody gets really passionate or there's a problem that needs to be solved. And that's one of the ways that, you know, we can solve it is through prevention versus reaction, you know, a topic that we unpack in another episode. So knowing how many and in what category you need. Another thing to consider is those you working towards your LCSW, your LCSWC, LISW, whatever your state calls their final independent license. If the training is directly related to treating one or more of your clients, you may be able to count it towards your indirect or general hours towards your LCSW. So for example, right now I'm in an incredible training, Shauna Marie Brown's Decolonizing Therapy for Black Folks. I live in a primarily Black and Brown area. I treat a lot of Black and Brown clients. So I signed up for her training. It's directly related to making sure that I'm providing the most competent care to my Black clients. So that counts towards my indirect hours. There was also a CEU option for this course. This year, I have so many that I'm just having the privilege of enjoying the content. But keeping that in mind too, you know, what's again, the purpose that I'm taking this training for, if the purpose is for CEUs, being very diligent, making sure that they're the right kind, right state, that they're counting for the right categories. Or, you know, if you've maybe already met them, you know, a lot of employers like where I work, we offer a ton of CEU opportunities. You might not need so many and can just sign up for trainings where you get to enjoy the content. Another thing, and this is something that I preach to my students quite a bit, if the person who created the intervention is still alive, you should take the training from them. Mm-hmm. So where are they training? Where's the program that they wrote and believe in? And was research being delivered? And that's really where we should be going to the source for the best information. A lot of the trainings can be like a cheap rehashing of the trainings that came from the source or, you know, kind of a cheap knockoff, if you will, of the good stuff. You know, for example, Marshall Linehan is alive and well. It has a learning institute. So if you're going to get trained in DBT, you would want to go directly to that source, right? You know, why would you pay for a watered down version when you can get it directly from Marshall Linehan and the folks that she trained and her program and her research? Everything else is going to be, you know, basically cited back to that versus you could get the real deal. So again, if someone who created the therapy, the intervention, the research that you're most interested in is still alive, even if you can find a cheap version of it, I would, you know, save the money to go right to the source.
Yeah, I guess you pay for what you get. So I guess at the end of the day, it comes down to doing your research on the specific training that you want to take. And because I feel like as a mental health provider and as a social worker, I don't know if it happens to you, but like my social media is always... it's like doing target ads trainings and just different tools and techniques that you can, you know, purchase and webinars to watch and all that. So we are already being targeted on social media and the internet by all these different training institutes or, you know, just different opportunities for professional development. So doing your research on which one is legit and which one is certified, goes a long way, I think.
Definitely. And asking people who've been to those trainings, there's a particular training that I see advertised really consistently and broadly to therapists that has a bunch of like mental health celebrities in it, you know, Peter Levine, Marsha Linehan, Bessel van der Kolk, you know, oh, they're all in this training. And it's like a $600 to $1,000, you know, type training. And like some people got a lot out of it and some people got nothing out of it. Mm-hmm. So if you, you know, again, are in larger Facebook groups asking people, how was this? What did you get out of it specifically? What do you wish was different? Can go a long way before you invest your money. Another thing that Imelda just mentioned is certification. So I see a lot of people get either tricked or overwhelmed by the word certification. So using DBT as an example again, there's a very large training organization that offers a DBT certification or that you're a CDBT therapist. It doesn't actually mean anything. That's just what they decided to call it. So typically a certification process includes you not just learning the therapy or skill, but spending consultation time practicing it, and then often doing observed sessions or recordings where someone scores your implementation and mastery of the skill. So for example, I'm in the process of getting certified for problem-solving treatment therapy. So I had to do a 3-hour training, right? So that would be like your introductory baseline. That's what most people choose to do. But then I had to do 12 weeks of 90-minute consultation groups. Oh, wow. Every Thursday night. And then I have to turn in recordings over the course of the next 6 months and be scored on them and get enough satisfactory scores to pass a certification. So certification is typically a lot bigger than just your 3 to 12 hour training. Mm-hmm. Another example is EMDR. So to be trained in EMDR, you typically do 2 or 3 long weekends, and then consultation hours are a part of just being trained in it. To be certified in EMDR, you have to do a lot more beyond that. You have to do ongoing consultation hours. You have to do a certain number of sessions. You have to turn in a notarized letter. So it's more complicated than just going to the training. But for a lot of skills and therapies, you don't need to be certified to use it or to use skills from it. But if it's a therapy that you really should be certified in, you know, can you commit to that certification process? Is it even possible? You know, do you work at an agency that would be supportive of an outside certifier coming in to review records? Or do you have a process for obtaining consent and releasing recordings to the trainer? You know, it can become quite a lot. And I really hate to see people waste money on trainings that they'll never carry a certificate for when they really need the certificate to use it well or at all. Mm-hmm. You know, for example, I did an introductory training for TFCBT, which is trauma-focused cognitive behavioral therapy. And it was a phenomenal training that, again, we have linked in this episode. I use a lot of TFCBT skills with clients. However, the certification process was totally out of reach for me and my agency, as was the manualized nature of how you do the care by the book. So I never went any further in my training. Again, it was great. I use skills, but I will probably never be certified in it.
Would you suggest, even before doing any of these trainings, to check with their agency, their supervisor, if this is something that kind of like fits into their schedule or their professional development? Because I can see some people who work in agencies that don't necessarily provide this type of trainings. Like you were mentioning, you know, EMDR, how the certification process is a little bit more complicated and they have to check records. And, you know, there's other steps that they need to be taking to receive certification. But what if your employer is like, yeah, we don't do that here.
And exactly. Or we're not going to allow someone to do that here.
And you just wasted your time and your money. I mean, not wasted time because you're learning useful skills, but you wouldn't be able to obtain the full certification because your employer is not cooperating with that. So,
right. Yeah, I would definitely, you know, always recommend, in addition to, you know, asking like, is this training worth it? You know, what are you really looking to get out of it? Can you get out skills that you can even implement at your employer? Are you not, you know, quote unquote, supposed to be using the skills mm-hmm. without certification? And then having a conversation, you know, if you have a license and you're working towards your independent license, you're probably under clinical supervision. It's great things to ask your clinical supervisor supervisor about, you know, if you have a contract clinical supervisor who's not a part of your agency, then your answers might be a little bit different. If you have a clinical supervisor who is a part of your agency, you know, they should know not only is this good for your professional development, but also is this something that the agency can see you all the way through the process of? Or is this something where maybe you're getting the training now, but when you go into private practice, you know, you can contract with someone who can provide you the rest of the certification process. Mm-hmm. So definitely checking in advance of all those things. Again, I will never probably be certified in TF-CBT. There's other ones, you know, that I've looked at, play therapy, sand tray therapy, that require a lot of that further supervision process. Or, you know, during COVID, we've been able to do a lot of trainings online that were sometimes, you know, we live in the fifth most populated city in the United States. However, not a ton of really cool trainings come here, actually. Mm-hmm. For the most part, they want us to drive to California or fly to Texas to get any of the larger trainings. But, you know, due to COVID, a lot of agencies are making them more accessible. So, but that doesn't necessarily mean, you know, if you need case consultation hours or you need observation hours, those might not have been approved to be virtual. So maybe your initial training was, but your follow-up pieces need to be done in person, which if your state hasn't had a lot of people historically trained in that skill or that therapy, it can be a little bit harder to obtain. So definitely not just doing your research for like, what do I want? What am I going to get out of it? But how do I see this all the way through and use it to its maximum benefit? You know, we talk a lot about doing top of license work. You know, if you have an LMSW, doing work at the very top of that license, things that only an LMSW can do. You know, again, as you're working towards your terminal license, your top of license work for your LCSW, does this support that? Does this make you a better therapist, a better clinician, or a better social worker?
Would you say that some of these trainings are still very focused on people who work in private practice?
I would say for a lot of them, yes. There are some that are actually like very specifically geared towards private practice, which if you're someone who wants to do that someday, it can be really important. You know, for example, I know some of the sex therapy certification programs, again, as well as some of the EMDR ones, will also include like a module or a portion or maybe some additional extra time where they teach you how to market yourself. You know, like, oh, now you can say you have this skill. This is what you want to put on your website. This is how you want to phrase it. This is how you find clients who are interested in someone who's certified in this, which is really geared at private practice, versus some trainings are very focused on community mental health. You know, this is how you do it with a large group of therapists. This is how you do it when you have entire families and services. This is how you do it in a school. This is how you do it, you know, in an in-home setting, in a setting where there are a lot of children in foster care, where there's a lot of children who are of different language speaking, or maybe they're monolingual for a non-English speaking language. How do you adapt it? So a lot of them will have, you know, kind of those concessions or those kind of advantages to them if they're geared towards one or the other. Again, talking to people about what their experience was in the training or reading the reviews. And again, also seeing the trainer's background. What do they do? Do they teach? Have they been faculty? Have they come from community mental health? Are they only in private practice and they have no idea how you would use it mm-hmm. in a setting where, you know, you're seeing 16 clients a day versus two clients and then an hour for lunch and then another two clients.
Very
and all my
clients
dynamics. Paid $200 an hour yeah. and they always do their homework, right? It's a very different setting to implement some of these therapies in.
Very true.
So in short, overall advice is to find something that you're excited to learn about, research and talk to people about who the best people are delivering this kind of training, and then think critically about how you use the skills and how you'll pursue their associated certification if they offer one. Mm-hmm. All of the trainings that we have mentioned in today's podcast are linked on the episode. And if you have any questions or have further information to share with us about some trainings that you've loved, please see us on our Instagram or Facebook page at Social Workers Break Room.
We'll see you next time.